Well, good morning. Good morning. And welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society. We welcome you no matter where you are on the spiritual, the religious, the sacred, the life journey. No matter the color of your skin, no matter your gender, no matter your sexual identity, you are welcome here. If this is one of your first times here, or your first time, you are invited in a little bit later in the service to introduce yourselves if you want to. We also encourage you to come more than one or more than two so you can get a better flavor of what we do here and what we're all about. Some Sunday mornings I do the service. I am Sandy Ingham, the consulting minister here. Some Sunday mornings other people from within the community do the service. And on many Sunday mornings people from outside of the community do the service. So welcome and please come back. Oh, this is, by the way, Soup Sunday. If this is your first Soup Sunday here, we really hope you will stay, and you don't have to pay if it's your first one. So please join us after the service. I have an announcement from our young people. Building the Museum is an activity for young people at our spring retreat. And our spring retreat is May 1st to the 3rd. If your parents are sending you to spring retreat, or if they are taking you there with them, we will spend some time creating the history of a new museum. This sounds really exciting to me. We will become museum archivists, managers of our museum holdings. Because the retreat site has limited historical objects available for our exploitation or exploration, we will need to bring some materials to assemble into our important exhibits. Holly Tellender, who is our Director of Religious Education, will give you instructions about the kinds of important materials we need. She's not here right now, but you can check our Facebook page or talk to me or Rick, are you involved in this?
Yes, I am.
Or talk to Rick if you have questions, since Holly's not here today. Be part of the world's great museum. The opening words today were written by Unitarian Universalist minister Barbara Peskin. For the beauty of the earth, this spinning blue-green ball, yes. Gaia, mother of everything, we walk gently across your back to come together again in this place, to remember how we can live, to remember who we are, to create how we will be. Gaia, our home, the lap in which we live, welcome us. Somebody light the chair, please. Flame of fire, spark of the universe that warmed our ancestral hearth, agent of life and death, symbol of truth and freedom, we strive to understand ourselves and our earthly home. The reading that I would like to share with you today is written by Unitarian Universalist minister Kathleen McTeague, titled Thinking Like a Stone. She writes, "My Aunt Mary has lived alone much of her life in a little prospector's cabin far inside the boundaries of Yellowstone Park, as a park biologist. She's a bit eccentric and also remarkably wise to the ways of the earth. For as long as I can remember, she has said that she thinks like a stone. She doesn't mean that she sits around listening to rocks as they wax eloquent in subtle, gravelly voices. She means that she has learned to anchor herself in geologic time. She observes the seasons keenly as they come and go, but she is tuned into rhythms that are unfathomably long, sweeps of time that the stones know. This is how I feel at the bottom of the Grand Canyon. She goes on, "This gives my Aunt Mary an unshakable equanimity right alongside her passion for the environment. She works tirelessly against the Earth's degradation, but she thinks like a stone and in geologic time. In geologic time, trees are a recent invention. The dinosaurs came and went just last week. And the whole span of human life has happened in the blink of a stony eye." With her consciousness anchored in this long and rocky view, my aunt says that the planet will survive us, no matter what we do, and will live well past our extinction. That's what gives rise to her serenity. "I find it very hard to think like a stone," writes McTeague. "I think like a human being, like a mother who wants to believe that her great-grandchildren will have a green earth to walk on, sweet air to breathe, the chance to see an osprey fishing in a lake, and to hear peepers trill out their awakening to the spring." However, this is where my aunt's wisdom might nevertheless wear off on me. If we can learn to think like a stone, then we might learn to think as though we are truly a part of the planet instead of merely living on it. We might learn to see with a sort of double vision that allows us our love and loyalty to our own kin, but stretches us beyond them. With that dual vision, we can start to live as though it is not human life that should be the measure of all things, it is the planet's life. We might learn not only to think like a stone, but to also think like an American chestnut or an elm, to think like a peeper, a cicada, a hawk, or a red fox, a vulture, a coral reef, or an Amazon butterfly. We might come to believe that their lives on Earth actually matter as much as our own. Thinking like a stone, we begin to know the truth at a bone-deep level that we are not living on the Earth. We are the Earth, as everything else is the Earth, rising into life in wild, extravagant variety. Just look around in April. And all made of the same handful of minerals, chemicals, and salty water into which we will dissolve when we die. We are the Earth made conscious, a unique and marvelous way in which the Earth itself can see, reflect, contemplate, and choose. The stones of our planet have been around for a long, long time, and they will be here as long as our bright little jewel of an Earth keeps spinning around the sun. If we want life to continue blossoming among those stones, we've got to take on their long view and then use our marvelous large brains to benefit the bright planet that gave rise to them in the first place. I don't think that I had ever heard the word Gaia until the mid-1990s, when I was going to seminary and living in Berkeley, California. Not surprising that the word would have entered my consciousness in either of those instances. Yet somewhere deep within me, I knew about Gaia. Kathleen McTeague writes that, thinking like a stone, we begin to know the truth at a bone deep level that we are not living on the earth. We are the earth. We are the earth. Do you grasp that? Can you grasp that? We are the earth made conscious, a unique and marvelous way in which the earth itself can see, reflect, contemplate, and choose. I didn't have to go to seminary to learn this. This is something that I have always known. I have intuited it for as long as I can remember. It probably didn't hurt that I grew up roaming the hills and the woods of Pennsylvania, but I have always known this. This past week, the one that ended yesterday, turned into old home week for me with many reunions. I met a lot of old friends during the week, literally and figuratively. This morning I want to introduce you to a few of them, and some of them you will already know. Many years ago, before I even thought about ministry, I was a member, as some of you know, of the Big Church. First Unitarian Society, right here in Madison. Some of you know it as the Frank Lloyd Wright Church. Eventually, I even worked there as secretary or office administrator, whatever title someone felt like giving me that day. It was then, as a member of that staff, that I began going to General Assembly, capital G, capital A, every year. GA, as it is usually referred to, is the annual meeting of our Unitarian Universalist Association, and it's in different parts of the United States and then Canada. Not anymore, we don't allow Canada in anymore, but then it was all over this country and Canada. Changed venue every year. We conduct the business of our association at General Assembly. We connect with friends. You would not believe how many workshops, seminars, and so on there are to choose from, as well as many services and musical events. We almost always have outstanding, often well-known, if not famous, speakers. Martin Luther King Jr. spoke there many years ago. Speakers such as David Corton. Know that name? Anybody know that name? Really?
I know the name. I can't remember what.
That's okay. At least you know the name. More about him in a few minutes. At one of these general assemblies, one of those famous speakers, whose name I can't recall, was an environmentalist, but before most people had any idea what that was and what it might mean, I remember being stunned when he said that if humans were to disappear tomorrow, fall off the face of the earth, none of the rest of creation would mind. In fact, they probably wouldn't even notice our absence. And in some cases, many species would even flourish without us around. And then the speaker asked us to imagine it the other way around. If the rest of creation disappeared tomorrow, what would happen to us humans? That may have been the defining moment for me on the road to being an activist for the environment. Well, one of the defining moments. Certainly another was stumbling into a class at Star King School for the Ministry taught by Johanna Macy. Now, I know you've heard of her because I've talked about Johanna here several times. The title of the class was World as Lover, World as Self. Also the title of the required book for the class. Macy, Buddhist scholar, expert in general systems theory, teacher, mentor, anti-nuclear activist. She's led so many workshops around the world, who could count? A mentor to countless numbers of people. She was one of the first Westerners to go to Chernobyl after the nuclear reactor disaster there to help the survivors work through their grief and sorrow. World as Lover, World as Self, the class and the book show us how to apply ancient philosophy to modern day life by teaching us to view the world and all the creatures in that world as extensions of ourselves. I have no problem with this because I believe that we are a part of Earth, that we are indistinguishable from all the rest of creation, in terms of value, importance, and meaning. I try, though, to remember that this is still a pretty strange belief for a whole lot of people, possibly even many of you in this room. And not just the concept that we are part of the earth, but much less beginning to understand the implications of that. In part two of these reflections, which will happen at the end of May, I'll give you Macy's theory of four different ways of viewing the world and which of those four she would like us to choose. I said that I stumbled into Macy's class. I certainly had no idea what I was getting myself into. If I had not been active in Beyond War, and I've talked about Beyond War before, but some of you weren't here when I did that. Beyond War is a grassroots organization that still exists that was out to obviously end war on the planet. If I hadn't been in that, because Macy was very active in that organization, she was active in California, I was active here in Wisconsin, if I wouldn't have gotten into the class if I hadn't had that little part to say. You had to audition to get into the class. You had to audition on green index cards, the dreaded green cards. Somewhere during this same time period, the mid to late 90s, I also met Wendell Berry and Bill McKibben, literally in McKibben's case. I met him a couple of times because our paths crossed when I was the minister in Plattsburgh, New York, and McKibben lives in the Adirondacks. And he teaches at Middlebury College in Vermont. Some of you have probably read McKibben, maybe even are familiar with the organization he started, 350.org. Look it up and be prepared to go to jail. Okay. Not for looking it up, but for doing what he wants us to do. Berry, as many of you probably know, Wendell Berry, writes mostly poetry and essays. And he does have a whole new collection of essays out titled Our Only World. Get it. Read it. Two other names associated with peace, justice, environmental activism, with mending this broken world. Two other people to whom I was introduced during the 80s and 90s, David Corton and Sister Miriam McGillis. How many of you know Sister Miriam? Oh, well, you're about to meet her. You might. Once I remind you, you might know her. I literally met her in the late 1980s maybe, as part of my work in Beyond War. She lives in New Jersey, but she was invited here to the Midwest by our Beyond War organization to tell us about Genesis Farm. And that's why we're working on the environment. Genesis Farm, which she and other Dominican sisters had just founded in Caldwell, New Jersey. You probably don't know about Genesis Farm. It has now been alive and well for over 25 years. It started in 1988 and is one of the oldest CSAs in the country. Community supported agriculture. It was formed to focus on connections between the health of the earth and of human communities within particular bioregions. If you go to their website, you will see, it says, among other things, humans must alter their most basic perceptions about themselves and the earth. The survival of the human species must be considered within the broader context of how nature is surviving. I was mesmerized by Sister Miriam and her enthusiasm about eating locally and bioregions and this connection between the health of the earth and the health of humanity. I remember thinking, okay, maybe in New Jersey you could eat locally all year round. That'd be a little tricky in parts of New Jersey too. But in Wisconsin, in the middle of the winter, we're all going to starve to death. Well, now my attempts to eat locally as much as possible are continually thwarted by avocados. Sister Miriam was a friend and student of Thomas Berry, not to be confused with Wendell Berry, and also no relation. Thomas Berry, some of you may have heard of. Jesuit priest, author, teacher, one of those amazing persons like Macy, who is so far ahead of their time, it is scary. Thomas Berry wrote Dream of the Earth, which some of you maybe have read. a well-known book in the environmental world, and also among liberal religious folks, Thomas Berry taught Sister Miriam that there is no such thing as a human community in any manner separate from the earth community. And then she went through a tremendous struggle around this because she's a Catholic nun. It seemed that what the Catholic priest, Thomas Berry, was teaching her about the cosmos was ultimately, in her words, incompatible with the biblical teachings that creation is finished. Many of you in this room know those teachings because you grew up with this. The ones that we've spent a lot of our adult years refuting and rebelling against. As McGillis put it, those teachings tell us that creation is finished, humans were made, history began, there was the fall, and history will end with the apocalypse. McGillis just couldn't live with that. She decided that we have made God in our image, and that stewardship, as had been presented to her as growing up Catholic and becoming this nun, these are her words again, that hasn't worked real well. She said it's too human-centered. It's the opposite. Earth is taking care of us. We don't take care of Earth. Earth takes care of us. To which I would add, Earth is trying to take care of us. So out of this came Genesis Farm. Now, I don't know for certain, but I will bet money that also out of this came agonizing by the popes over what to do with her. Some of you know this happened with Joan Chittister, and they couldn't excommunicate her, really. No, that's another story. So we have all this wonderful thinking and experimenting and projects and everything imaginable going on, swirling all around out there during the 80s and the 90s. And of course, it's still going on into the 2000s. And all of these light bulb moments where all sorts of people are coming up with initiatives that go way beyond what we're doing to save the planet. You just go right on recycling. That's good. That's fine. But it's not really going to matter. I don't think. We have to change the system, and obviously this is not original thinking on my part. I think we lost track of the environmental issue because of 9/11. And then, of course, we have to remember that none of this is really new. None of this thinking of how, that we are a part of the Earth, this isn't new. This has been around as long as there have been people around. Think of ancient peoples, think of the Native Americans here, think of ancient traditions, think seventh generation teachings. Turn to 550 in the back of your hymnal and look at the reading there that's attributed to Chief Noah Self about, you've all heard it, this we know, the earth does not belong to us, we belong to the earth, we've used that here. All things are connected, like the blood which unites one family. All things are connected. Whatever befalls the earth befalls the sons and daughters of the earth. We did not weave the web of life. We are merely a strand in it. Whatever we do to the web, we do to ourselves. Well, I think most of us in this room probably believe that Native Americans understood the importance of taking care of the earth in a way that has seemed foreign to us. I mean, we called them savages. At least we don't do that anymore. And we're getting more and more interested in how Native Americans lived in harmony with the earth. There was a period of time when Unitarian Universalists, I think, were overly concerned about co-opting other traditions. I think we can learn from Native indigenous cultures without disrespecting them or failing to attribute what we learned to the people who came before us. That was before I walked into the laundry room yesterday and did a double take when I saw the box of detergent that was named Seventh Generation. I believe I've used some Seventh Generation products, but that's maybe co-opting. How will we avoid environmental disaster? How do I avoid sending you out of here on a downer? How do we avoid destroying Mother Earth? Is it already too late? That clock is ticking. That clock is ticking loudly. Are we listening? What we have done thus far to heal this planet is too little, I think. Question is it also too late. I am very, very frightened for my grandchildren's future. I think even if I didn't have grandchildren, I would be frightened for the future, for future generations. We have an obligation to leave this world in better shape than we found it. But despite all these noble sentiments of mine, most of the time over the past decades, since I initially met those friends I've been telling you about this morning, most of the time I try not to think about what a mess we're in, what a mess we've made of the environment. I try not to think about the fact that Earth Day may be pointless. I try not to think about the fact that my recycling, my bicycling, my walking, my whatever I do, probably doesn't make much of a difference. We humans are like those frogs we used to talk about in Beyond War presentations. Well, we were talking about the proliferation of nuclear weapons then, but we could just as easily have been talking about the lack of interest in paying attention to global warming. You know that story where you place these frogs in a pot of water and then you turn the water on, simmering, and they don't notice that it's getting hotter and hotter and hotter until it's too late to jump out of the boiling water. Not many years ago, I'd say 3 or 4 years ago, I was asked to be on a panel at Edgewood College with graduate students to present the religious perspective of Earth Day. It was right around this time of year, and saving the environment. And I was, there were a lot of young people, of course, and I was astounded when the young man beside me, during a break, said to me, "Well, people my age, we don't go out in nature. We never go outside. We're not interested in going outside. We're not interested in nature." I hit him over the head. No, I didn't. Now that's offset a lot for me when I take those hikes in and out of Grand Canyon, which I will be doing next week. I meet lots of young people. Obviously, they respect nature. They wouldn't be at the bottom of Grand Canyon, I hope, if they didn't. Oh, maybe a month ago, I went into a coffee shop. It had been really cold. It was that February, really cold stuff. But that was ending. It was all, you know, it was warm. It was 20 above zero. And as I walked through the parking lot, there was a pickup truck running. And so I went in and said, "There's a pickup truck running. Somebody needs to turn their truck off." Was anybody in the truck? It was obvious that the two young women working there knew who owned the truck. There's this young man standing right there, and he's kind of shifting around. And they said to him, "Go turn off your truck." And he said, "No, it's cold." Then we all said, "No, it's not cold. It's not that cold." And then, you know, and I said to him, "Well, you know, it's really not a good idea for the environment." I got on my soapbox. And he looked uncomfortable, and he looked puzzled, he said, well, that's not my problem. The environment's not my problem. That was the wrong button to push for me. And I said, "Yes, it is. That is." He said, "It's not my fault." I said, "Yes, it is. It's your fault. It's my fault." I don't know. I hope that's not indicative of the early 20-year-olds. And then maybe sometimes there is cause for hope. Some of you may have read about the Kirtland's warbler. Warbler, hard word to say. You know that little bird? It's 5 inches long. It's on the endangered. You don't know this bird? It's a beautiful bird. It's on the endangered federal and state endangered species list. 40 years ago, there were 300 of them in Wisconsin. Last year, there were about 25. Only 13 singing males left. But one was just found, abandoned one, in the Bahamas, which is where it's supposed to be for 3 months of the winter. And I ask you, who's smarter, the bird or us? But it had made that trip and, you know, been found down there. I can't fathom this, making that trip when you're 5 inches long from here to the Bahamas. But perhaps what has given me the most hope in years, and this is most of what will be part two, has been reconnecting with those old friends of mine from 20 to 25 years ago. All of them, except Johanna Macy, are featured in this current issue of Yes Magazine, something else I really recommend you read. It comes out quarterly, and it will keep you from wallowing around in too much despair. Yes magazine, spring 2015 issue. And there was David Corton. There was an interview with him. I met Corton, I didn't actually meet him, but I heard him speak at a General Assembly in the mid-1990s. He had just written a book titled, When Corporations Rule the World, in which, among other things, he made the case that humans are on a path to self-extinction. This was mid-1990s, so that's what, 20 years ago? He presented this well, and I agreed with him. Well, he has a new book, just published. It's only in paperback, so it is not prohibitively expensive, and it's not hard to carry around to your favorite coffee shop, so you can berate people when they're leaving their car engines on. But his new book is Change the Story, Change the Future, A Living Economy for a Living Earth. Like Sister Miriam McGillis, Corton has been heavily influenced by Thomas Berry and his book, Dream of the Earth. Berry maintained that humans need a different story, a different narrative about life on Earth. A storyline that Corton says gives us a powerful reason to live, a story that answers the basic question, why? And that's what Corton's new book is about, Changing the Story. His title for the old, outdated, outmoded story is Sacred Money and Markets. His title for the new story that he hopes humanity is moving towards is Sacred Life and Living Earth. These stories are two completely different ways of looking at the world and also of planning how to organize human society. I'll let Corton's words sum it up. You either see life as a means to make money, or you see money as simply a number, useful for keeping accounts, in service to life, but of no value in itself. Buying into the sacred money and market story that money is wealth and the key to happiness locks us into indentured servitude to corporate rule. Locks us into indentured servitude to corporate rule. In other words, in my words, if we continue to place a monetary value on everything, commodify all aspects of life, we are doomed. Humanity will not survive. Just a caveat here for certain people. This does not mean that we will cease to have material goods. This does not mean that we're going to go back and live in caves and be hunter-gatherers. It means we'll keep buying, but we'll buy local. We won't be slaves anymore to corporations. We'll have more sustainable, viable farms modeled on existing farms like Genesis. We'll be smarter. We will change the story. I recently read an article that the price of beef is supposedly rising dramatically. Like it just tripled in the last 6 or 8 months. Why? Because of demand. I thought, there's a simple solution here, which would have so many ramifications for the environment. Don't eat beef. Or if I'm talking to my son-in-law, I say don't eat so much beef. The system isn't broken. It is way beyond broken. It is self-destructive. And it is supported by a lie, by a false story. The only legitimate purpose of any economic system should be to serve life, to serve us as living beings, making our living in co-productive partnership with living Earth. You will have to wait until the end of May to find out what the true human story is, or could and should be. Part two of these reflections will concentrate on the new, but not really new, story titled Sacred Life and Living Earth. To get to that story, we'll need to more closely examine what we mean when we say we believe in science and reason. And if you were here last week for that wonderful service, which our 8th to 11th graders presented the results of the survey on what we believe here at Prairie, then you learned that we apparently have a lot of faith in science and reason. You might even say we worship it. You might even say that we never question what the role of science and reason is in today's world. But these old friends want to show us that there is another way, that there are other options. Closing words are actually in the back of the hymnal, number 545, written by Langston Hughes. In time of silver rain. In time of silver rain, the earth puts forth new life again. Green grasses grow and flowers lift their heads. And over all the plain, the wonder spreads of life, of life, of life. In time of silver rain, the butterflies lift silken wings to catch a rainbow cry. And trees put forth new leaves to sing in joy beneath the sky when spring and life are new. Go in peace, greet your neighbor, eat your soup, and enjoy spring.